What is up, Hockey IQ listeners? I'm here to chat about our newest sponsor, Sensarena. Your brain is one of the most important parts of your body. Why not invest in a tool that allows you to train it? With Sensarena, athletes can gain a competitive edge using VR training. Players are able to go through a scenario thousands of times without having to step foot on the ice. No more waiting around for puck touches or perfect scenarios. Sensarena can enhance reaction time, decision-making, and multitasking abilities, making you the next MVP. I mean, if the LA Kings are using it, it's got to be good. With our promo code HockeyIQ, you receive $50 off an annual plan purchase. Head on over to sensarena.com to check it all out.
On today's podcast, we bring on Jamie Rice of Babson College. Jamie's the head coach. He's been there for many years, since the mid-2000s. He's the guy that we've heard a lot of recommendations from, specifically Kenny Rausch, who's been on the podcast before, and Dave Reese, who's also been on the podcast. So finally, we got him on board, and it was a great conversation. Very, very different coach, but very modern. Big believer in games to teach the game. And it's even gotten to the point where he no longer is even bringing a whiteboard out for practice. Just the culture he's built there is quite something amazing. Really excited to share this episode. It's just so good and so personal. This is not someone who's selling something. He's educating, and he really cares about being invited to his players' weddings rather than winning, even though he is the all-time winningest coach at Babson and will continue to rack him up and is always a top team. So really excited to share this episode. Without further ado, Jamie Rice. On the podcast today, we have Jamie Rice of Babson Hockey. Jamie, great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be on tonight and getting ready for NHL playoff hockey like everybody else.
Beautiful. You're the first guest we've had on that was a recommendation from another podcast guest. Kenny Rausch was like, you have to have Jamie Rice. Finally made it happen. So no pressure, but you got a lot to live up to here. So yeah, maybe give us a quick background story of how you got to Babson and coaching there for the past, what, 16 years or so?
Through 17, starting 18 now. Grew up in Newton, Mass, played youth hockey, went to prep school, wound up going to Babson. Babson being a business school, almost all my friends, teammates, roommates went on to business, and I just had the coaching bug and started for a year at Colby. I think the salary was $4,000, quite a move for a Babson grad. Then spent a year at Dartmouth, 5 years at Brown, 2 more years back at Dartmouth, 5 years at Northeastern, and the Babson job opened in the summer of 2004, and back I came, and it was you know, a really easy fit for me having gone there. My wife had gone there. It really was home. It was close to home for me. But it's a place I love and gave a lot to me. So it was easy for me to come back and be a part of the program again.
And I believe there's a story out there as well of one of your sons was at the door and basically saying, hey, Dad, maybe the D1 life on the road, nonstop recruiting wasn't for.
Yeah, my son was 2, and I was going to Texas to see the North American League Championships. This would have been spring of 2004 before the Babson job had opened, and I had a black bag, and the only way I can describe it is like the Catch Me If You Can. It kind of zippers open flat, so you know it's a great bag to travel with, and I just put it by the door, and he was 2, and he started crying, and you know, my wife and I talked that night, and again, the Babson job wasn't open. I was at Northeastern, and enjoying it and collecting a lot of miles on Northwest Airlines and things like that. And, you know, we just talked and said, you know, this is going to be really hard to do as he gets older. And my twin daughters weren't born yet, but, you know, it really kind of hit me, you know, right in the head there. That was like, geez, it's a great life for me, but it's not so great for my family when you're traveling 100 to 120 days a year. And you're, you know, even your free time at home, you're going to a local game or you want to watch some hockey. And so that is a true story. 2 years old in tears, you know, talk about imprinting. Maybe it's why he plays football now and not hockey. It's a little bit of a poison apple.
He'll probably play men's league before we know it.
Yeah, he's talking about playing club at the college he's going to go to. He's going to play football there, but he's talking about maybe I'll go up for club hockey. So we'll see. I mean, he likes it. He loves football, and that's his passion.
Wasn't Dad also a two-sport varsity athlete at Babson?
Yeah. Back in the dark ages when you could do it, before there was specialization and crossovers of season, before hockey was 13 months a year and baseball was 13 months a year. Yeah, I played – I was fortunate to play baseball and hockey at Babson, and I also played football in high school. I was – you know, I just, whatever the season was, I picked it up and played it, and that was good. I also was of the age, Greg, where, you know, lifting would cause you to be muscle bound. So that's probably why I have the frame I have too, that, you know, I'm not a big, huge physical guy, but I was fortunate to play both. And I loved both sports. And ironically, when I took the Colby job, my other opportunity was to go to Salisbury as an assistant hockey and assistant baseball coach. And who knows where that would have led, but here I am today.
Coaching was clearly going to happen for you one way or the other, so that's awesome to hear. And you've kind of found an interesting style that was definitely before its time, and I still think you're on the cutting edge and not enough people are doing it, especially at the high level, and teaching the game through games. So obviously you got your simple games like tag, but then also many constraint led games where, you know, you can play 3-on-2 down low and there's a backside pressure. If you ever have three guys on one side, okay, you guys are out and doing somersaults, next group goes in, something like that. So I'm curious of where that came from and how you jumped on that earlier than most.
Yeah, well, I think probably two really distinct events happened. One, I was really fortunate in Massachusetts. We used to have a program called the Massachusetts Satellite Training Program. And basically all the national festival teams for USA Hockey at 15, 16, and 17 filtered through the satellite program. So the Mass kids were selected, then they participated in this program. And actually kids as young as 12 and 13 and 14 actually took a group of, I think, 13-year-olds to Kent State a long time ago now. But so we had a lot of kids from 12 to 17 in the summer who were training. And with that, there were a lot of coaches. Again, my first year was 1996 with them. I've been with Mass Hockey ever since, but there were a lot of coaches who really opened my eyes, guys who had worked with some of the legends like the Jack Parkers, the Tim Taylors, some of the guys who were legends themselves, varied backgrounds, but all of them were really eager. And it was a mini lab. So you really could kind of expand and try things. And it's where, you know, I first got introduced to a few games that weren't just, you know, 3-on-3 cross ice. And a lot of people will say to me, hey, tell me about your small area games. I'm like, I hate that phrase because it's really games with constraints, because we'll play full ice or three quarters ice or half ice. And the second one was in 97. Bob Gaudette and I went up and spent a day with Bill Beeney at Middlebury, who really is the father kind of all this in my mind's eye. I'm sure other people were doing it, but from my introduction to it. And Bill really had Middlebury in a great spot at that point. They were nationally successful, wildly successful. He was a sharing coach. He was a giver. And Bob and I went up and spent, you know, we played golf and had lunch and had dinner and spent another day with him and just talked about all these things. And so those two events kind of ignited my passion. And then coaching in the satellite program, being fortunate a couple times to have teams on my own while I was an assistant, but be the head coach of like the Mass 15 or 17 team and have them in the satellite program where you're running 16 to 18 to 20 practices a summer with really high level kids, but it was a blank canvas. So I just started, you know, mixing in, taking someone's, you know, 3-on-3 cross ice and changing the rink and how it's played on. And, you know, could we play that half ice? Could we play it in a quarter of the ice? Could we play a third of the ice? Could we play it 2-on-1? Could we play it with a guy standing out as an outlet? Could we add guys with sticks over, you know, whatever it was, and just kind of kept tinkering and tinkering with it and continue to this day. I mean, probably this past year came up with, you know, two new games that we use this season that just kind of evolved from other games.
Through that, do you have any favorite games or games that your kids really enjoy? I was talking to some of your ex-players and they really enjoyed Levels. They said that's one of their favorites. I actually do the same thing. For me, it's got to score off a one touch. So tip, rebound, one timer. So it works on getting open, looking for players. One of the teams I do is basically an off-season team since the high school season here in Ohio is so short. So they're all stars and they don't know how to pass with each other. So like, that's my way of getting at it. What about you?
Levels is a favorite, I think, for a lot of reasons. The first one is it's our last thing we do before a game weekend. So Thursday practice, you know, it's the one thing I think anybody who's ever played at Babson for our program could probably tell you exactly what the practice is, the five things we do, and that's all we do. We turn the radio up loud. The only caveat is it's my playlist, so it tends to be a lot of mix of 80s hard rock or 80s rap, whatever it may be. But I love levels. I like, you mentioned the one time a game, you know, we play 3-on-3, score at either net. The only way you can score is a one timer. And, you know, the first time you play it, everyone kind of backs out to their offside with the big ceiling scraper. And then as players start to go and they develop, you get some smart players who start to bank it off the boards to themselves, but just learn to one time a puck on their forehand, learn to one time a puck on their backhand, learn to one time a puck on a rebound. And I think what a game like that really encourages mindset. I mean, you mentioned the one timing a puck, you know, to me, that's really attacking mindset as much as it is physical, because very rarely, if you took the average group of kids and said, let's go work on one timing, they stand 10 feet apart and he slides them a perfect pass. And when it's not perfect, I'll slide it back. And they're not attacking mindset. They're attacking a physical skill. But you play 3-on-3, either net one time only, you're really attacking the mindset. And we'll show our guys clips of like Brad Marchand scoring on a one-timer where his mindset was as the puck was coming, he's going to one-time it. So when the puck bounces and he puts it in off his shaft, it's still a great goal. You know, to the average person, like, oh, well, you never practice that, but he had the mindset to one-time it. You know, I like a game that we've just kind of keep adapting every year. We call it Bulldog 3.0 now, which is a transition-based game. I would say any game that involves transition is my favorite, because I think that's how the game is played. I mean, I think the game is transitory in nature and necessity. And so anything that we play, we try to play with transition.
When you say transition, are you talking like a team comes out, now the other team has to go behind their own net, regroup? Is there a certain way that you like to set up your transitions, or is it more of like a mindset within the games and the constraints?
We probably have about 11 transition games we play every week. And they're all different. I think for me, transition is increasing, one, the rapidity with which they think about it. So how quickly can I process that we are on offense and we're going to defense, or we're on defense and we're now going to offense? So how quickly can I think it? And then when I think it, how quickly can I recognize the support? So if we're transitioning from offense to defense, how quickly can I recognize that I'm either defending at the puck or I'm supporting the guy who is defending at the puck? And if we're transitioning on offense, how quickly can I recognize who has the puck and where he needs help and where the support is and where the defenders are? So I think, you know, almost all of our transition games revolve on two things. One, you're not leaving the surface. You're not skating behind the net or doing anything like that when you lose the puck. You are still continuing to play the game as it's going on. So there's no real, you know, advantage to the offensive team when they gain the puck, because it's not like the defenders vacate something. And two, the other reason that we play it that way is I think you get these incredible situations that are much more game-like, one, but two, can be so varied and uncontrolled, which I think really helps grow their understanding of transition. Ultimately, what I want is a team that I don't have to say anything to on game day. Let them play, let them figure it out. Let them play the game because of the, you know, hopefully at the end of a year for us, 70, 80 practices, you know, maybe 1,000 repetitions of different transitory examples that happen in practice. And then, okay, here's a game. I remember that, you know, that's a screwdriver. This is a saw. This is a hammer. Whatever the job needs, they have the right tool in their basket at that point.
That's a great analogy there. We don't want just players having hammers in their heads or in their hands going after a screw. Not going to work out so well.
We say it to them all the time. You know, if it's a nail, use a hammer. Yeah, a screwdriver will work, but not as well as a hammer. But if it's a screw, yeah, a hammer will work, but not as good as a screwdriver. And just keep, you know, keep understanding. And again, because there is, it's not football where you play for 8 seconds and you stop, you line up across from each other. You know, aside from a face-off, very rarely does it ever look the same. I mean, if your team and my team played a 7-game series, there might not be an identical play in all those minutes we play. You know, 7 games, we go a 7-game series and never have a situation where there's an exact same thing, except for perhaps a face-off. So if the players can't assess, understand, figure out, and ultimately implement what they should be doing, then, you know, they can't say to you, hey, coach, can we stop the game? Because they weren't lined up where you said they were. And this year in COVID, you know, because of COVID restrictions, you know, we didn't use a whiteboard ever in practice. We tend not to go to the whiteboard in a regular year, but we never even brought one out this year. Because again, to me, I'm never going to be able to write something on the whiteboard except for a drill, which we maybe do two drills out of our entire week of practice, the rest of them are games. There's never going to be a situation where they're lined up exactly like I show them on the whiteboard. Okay, the D stands here. He has the puck. Oh, what if he's not there? We can't call timeout. We can't stop the game. So just let them continue to figure it out on their own. I think the one thing about this people sometimes misunderstand is I think there's tremendous teaching opportunities in playing games in practice because there's immediate feedback. And it's not like we're just throwing the pucks out there and saying, hey, go have at it. You know, whatever you want to do. I think our staff does a good job. You mentioned Kenny Rausch. I mean, we've had some exceptional people coach with us. Kenny Rausch and Mike Bavis. Brian McConnell was the captain of the under 18 team, was on the world junior team. My current assistant, Matt Keating, Jason Smith, who's at Brown now. I mean, we've had some exceptional coaches. Brendan Fleming was a scout, but we're not just throwing the pucks out there and saying, okay, we're just going to play games. There's so much opportunity to give the kids feedback while you're playing games in practice and talk about things. And the odd time will stop it for everybody just to point out some real, you know, 30,000 foot view of something. But other than that, it's, you know, continue to let them figure out. And what I was going to say is when the kids can think independently, that's my reward. I don't need to be out the front of the band. I want to be at the back, kind of enjoying the view and a little bit like a sheep herder, occasionally poke them right or poke them left, but they're running the ship.
Has it always been like that for you, or has it been a changing of the times where I know most coaches seem to go from the yelling at the kids, telling the kids how to do it, and then eventually getting to the point where they start asking questions where clearly you are. Do you get there early in your career, or is this something you've kind of evolved with?
When I got to Babson, I knew two things. One, I was going to do it my way. And again, from 96 to the time I got to Babson, I was fortunate in the satellite program to have the opportunities to coach kids at a high level and national festivals, but in Massachusetts for, you know, 10 weeks in the summer and try these things out. So I was going to do it my way. And two, although hockey is very important to me and at Babson, we've done well and we've got a great, rich and proud program. No one's standing over my shoulder asking me why we're doing something. You know, there's nobody saying, well, you know, hey, he shouldn't be doing this in practice, or he shouldn't be playing that, or this kid has a scholarship. Why is he in the stands? So there's a certain amount of autonomy. Really, since I've been at Babson in 2004, this is the only way I've known to do it. I think it's expanded where we've gotten even more away from drills in any form. But there's also things that we do that, you know, my coach was a great coach and I'm very fortunate to have played for Steve Sterling. I wouldn't be where I am today without him. You know, we didn't have the radio in the van on the way to a game. Conversely, the guys have the radio on in the locker room all the time, you know, and as I said, on Thursday practice, it's on the whole time. I don't even bring my whistle out basically. I mean, it's just like, okay, this is your thing. But again, I think within that, there's opportunities to instruct and help and teach and provide some guidance. But we've also been really fortunate to have a lot of guys who I think our freshmen come in and about the first 3 weeks they look around and ask the older guys like, is this really what we do? Like, this is how we practice? And they're like, yeah, just hang tight. But by the time they get to juniors and seniors, like that's why we didn't need a whiteboard. It just flows seamlessly. I think the other thing I should have mentioned, Greg, too, is I think the one thing that I really believed in more than anything when I finally got the head job was I think the game is about competing. And I'm not talking like everyone, oh, it's a competitive game. Like it really, at the end of the day, either you have the puck or they have the puck. It's a really simple game. Kenny Rausch used to always say it's a simple game confused by many. I think he got that from his coach, Jack Parker. You know, it's not about me. It's everything is beatable. Everything's defendable. So if you start with this competitive game and anybody can, you know, hey, here's this power play, we'll always score. Or here's this man down, they'll never score. Well, those are both going to be true, proven false. But at the end of the day, it'll be a competitive thing. And I just wanted to have an environment where the kids really competed hard, competed every day. And I think competing with one another brings them closer to each other.
Talking about team bonding, I know you're a big fan of team bonding, whether that be a roommate raffle or Secret Santa. So yeah, everyone tells me that, man, this Jamie Rice guy is really relaxed, but don't mess with Secret Santa. He's very passionate about it, whether it be the Mount Rushmore or the spicy salsa.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of teams do Secret Santa, and I laugh at myself all the time. You know, I don't take myself I take hockey seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. I mean, I've got a hat on here, but I'm giving Mr. Clean a run for the money here with the hairline. You know, so Secret Santa, I think, is a traditional thing. The roommate raffle, I think, is ours. You know, maybe trademark it. I don't know if anybody else does in the country, but we do. And what we do is we have a 5-gallon mayonnaise jar that's empty of mayo, and there's ping pong balls with the 26 numbers of the guys on our team. And, you know, my first couple of years, we didn't do this. We used to go on a road trip and I'd sit there and I'm going to put Joey and Steve together. I'm going to put these two guys together. These guys are line mates. These guys are roommates. And finally one time, like, you know what, this got to be a better way. So we got this mayonnaise jar and all the ping pong balls. And I come into the room and I shake it up and the guys start going crazy. And basically our roommates on the road, we pick one ball that starts it. And then whoever ball's picked, the next guy picks the next one. So you basically have one guy picking and the other guy, then once he's in a room, picks his roommate. And then it keeps going on and on and on. So, you know, I pick ball number two and then player number two, jersey number two, picks his roommate. And then whoever he picks the next room to start. And I mean, the guys get into it on a Thursday when we do it. I mean, I wouldn't say it's up there with winning, but it's pretty close. You know, the guys get into it. And I just think, you know, ultimately, you win a lot more with guys who care about one another. And I think when you lose with guys who care about one another, there's some solace in it because they're in it together. But they also, they want to dig a little deeper. And, you know, I think for us, Dan Coyle's book, you know, The Culture Code, I really believe everything's about culture. So whether it be how we practice or what we do or how we come out for the lineup, for the national anthem or the starting lineups, to our jerseys, to what we do. You know, we try to do everything revolving around a culture of being the best we can be, but having it be fun.
Well, I got a great quote on fun from a well-known hockey coach. It has to be fun and it's going to be fun. Kids have to play. They're not having fun standing in line. And this is where it gets really good. Do you have more fun when you go to a restaurant or while you're standing in line waiting to get your food to eat? I definitely screwed that one up, but do you want to be standing in line all the time? So I think that you've got the fun idea down with the games.
Yeah. But, you know, I think I'm blessed to have three kids. You know, my wife's a tremendous mother. I've coached youth sports. You mentioned earlier how I played two sports. Like, sports to me was always fun. Like, I was going to coach, I was going to teach, because the most fun I had was at practice every day, like just going out there and before practice and football, pretending I was, you know, Bob Greasy, dating myself now, and in the backyard, pretending I was Louis Tiant and imitating Carlton Fisk's home run. And then, you know, being Bobby, like, I just loved to play. And I think as I started coaching and it became a job, the kids haven't lost the fun, but sometimes the adults can interfere with it being fun. You know, we do very little video, and that's probably not a good thing. There's probably some coaches out there like, oh, talk about get with the times. But I want them to come to the rink, be excited to come to the rink, have a few laughs. You know, as I said, I poke fun at myself, and I know the guys, I think the position of being a head coach creates some, you know, some level of, you know, seriousness, but, you know, we're giving it to each other all the time. And they're giving it to me and I'm giving it back. And I just want them to come to the rink. And then when I had kids, I had already been coaching for a while. I started coaching youth hockey and youth baseball. And, you know, I did the same thing. I'm like, hey, let's make it fun. And it's funny. I think when you first say that to people, they kind of look at you cross-eyed and say, oh yeah, but they got to do this, this, and this. And almost everybody I've ever worked with, particularly at the youth level, by the end of the year, like, you know, this was great. Because at the end of the day, whether it be playing AAA or midget or junior or college or high school, let alone the possibility of playing the NHL, there's going to be more kids falling by the wayside before they get there. So let's make an enjoyable journey. And it's more fun for me. I mean, it's I like going to the rink. You know, when you asked about how I stumbled on the games piece, one of it was, I can remember some days as assistant where if I see one more two-on-one from one goal line to the other, I'm going to throw up. I was bored to tears, you know, and with the games, every day is different. Every time we could play one game every day for 82 days and it would always be different. It would never be the same. And that's, to me, that's enjoyable. That's the teacher. That's the passion in playing the game and coaching it.
So I've got a few follow-ups on that, but I'm curious, do you put games in for your game warm-ups? Are you playing, you know, some games around the circles and in the neutral zone and whatnot? Or are you more traditional on that?
The game day is completely the players. I have no idea what we do for a warm-up. I have never watched us warm up. They come to the rink. We talk for 1 minute. They do whatever they do. They go out for warm-ups. They come in. We talk for 2 minutes. And then we go play. I really believe that game day belongs completely to the players. So aside from us standing motionless at the anthem and coming out by number, whatever they do after that is completely up to them. So I honestly could not tell you what they do. I know that Ed Cini, who was another guy who really, you know, had spoke about games and games and practice and doing it. And he was a Bill Beeny disciple or mentee of Bill. I know that he used to scrimmage in warmups and the NCAA outlawed it. He used to come out in two different colors and get two nets and they used to play cross ice. And the NCAA said you couldn't do it anymore. So there you go. It's like the old football coaches talk about, you know, it's not the no fun league. Whatever they do, they do.
I love that, going cross ice. I would be that guy that would totally try that. But clearly I can't go do the NCAA. Not allowed. that's fun. But continuing down this road here, obviously, you know, I want to say probably 50% of parents are usually first generation hockey parents. Might be a little bit different up in Massachusetts where you guys are at, or Minnesota, things like that. But, you know, there's a lot of new parents out there. You know, what would be some of the advice that you would give them? And I'll just leave it very open to what you're seeing with your role and in your career.
The first thing is there's nothing wrong with your kid not doing what everyone else is telling you they have to do. I'm probably kind of stubborn that way. I've always believed that if everybody's telling you, hey, you got to play for this team, or you got to go to this camp, or you got to do this program, or you got to sign up for this website, I'm usually like, I'm going the other direction. So,
unless it's the Hockey IQ podcast, in which case, exactly. The newsletter podcast, you have to sign up for it.
Give it a plug. you know, I think it's okay to kind of find your own way. I think that'd be first and foremost. Two, it is youth sports. In essence, it is sports for youth. It is nothing more. It is nothing less. It is not at 8, at 6, at 10, at 12, at 14, at 16, the die is not cast on what your future will be. And if you don't enjoy it along the way a little bit, you know, you're going to miss out. My son is going to be a freshman in college. So he's basically at the stage now where his next move is out of the house. He's going to college. He's going away. He'll come home in the summer and my wife and I will ride his ass about coming in at 1 a.m., whatever it may be. But this is it. He's going out the door. And those 19 years went really quick. I mean, you started asking me about the story about him crying with my black bag. I mean, I can see that like it was yesterday, and he's going out the door now. So enjoy everything. It's okay to get Dunkin' Donuts or Dairy Queen or Tim Hortons after a game. If they won, if they lost, it doesn't matter. It has no effect. If you want to get them slush, have at it. If you want to give them Twinkies, have at it. Enjoy it. I think the other piece of it all is that no one is going to go through a youth hockey or youth sports career, very few people, and have this magical you know, never lose a game, never have a losing season, always win a national championship, always win a district championship, always win a state championship. There's probably a few that have. I've told this story at the Mass Hockey Clinics. You know, my Bantam team was 64-0, and we lost in the state championship game 8-3. 64-0, last game of the year, you think, geez, you know, we got this in the bag, and we didn't win it. And I still remember all those guys I played with, and I remember that game, but the 64 games before it, I don't have a huge recollection of the game against Burlington in December of, you know, 1980. I couldn't tell you what that was like. But I do remember all those guys. I remember we had a lot of fun, and it was, you know, at that point, community-based hockey. But it's athletics, hockey in particular, are great, great, great things to be a part of. You know, don't let your passion for it get in the way of your child's passion and development for whatever they want to become.
Yeah, those are great words. And kind of what you're getting at a little bit, and I think something that I'm very cognizant of is, you know, there's going to be failure along the path here. No doubt. Everyone has it. I mean, that's some of everyone's greatest learning moments are born out of failure. But it seems like a lot of people, whether it be players themselves, parents or coaches that don't like to lose, kind of forget that. Like, failing is part of it, is part of the growth. And I always say, you know, it's kind of like the golf ball. The reason the dimples are there is it makes you go further. Those little knocks make the ball go further, better flight like trajectory, all that. So yeah. I'm a big fan of the golf ball because, you know, yeah, the reason why it's got dimples.
You know, Ted Williams, who said, you know, if you fail 7 out of 10 times in baseball, you're a Hall of Famer. You know, you're a 300 hitter. You know what? I've got 3 kids. I hurt when they hurt. You know, I am not a, you know, hey, I've made plenty of mistakes as a parent. You know, if I get them down here on this podcast right now, you'd have another 4 hours. I don't do things perfectly. I do think understanding the difference between them failing at something or having some failures is a lot different than them hurting, and trying to balance that connection between, hey, you're upset, but you know, you're upset because you really care about this, or you really are into this, or it means a lot to you, or, hey, it's going to be instructive, it can help you. You know, I think that part's good. I think that letting them, there's a book out, I think it's called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. You know, the kids need to fall and pick themselves up. And, you know, failure doesn't always, it's not a panacea, but failure can grow grit and resilience. It can build toughness. It can build dedication, desire, and determination. So I think that, you know, failing is not a bad thing at all. I think any psychologist would tell you that's a big part of the learning component. You know, you just don't want to be in an environment where it's abusive. Or, you know, I always tell people at the coaching clinics in Massachusetts, like, if the kid's late for practice, it ain't their fault. They don't drive. You know, it's the parents. You know, so if the coaches are ruining it or parents ruining it, I think that's, you know, that's a different thing than failing. But again, you're going to lose some games. You're going to lose some battles. You're not going to make a team. You're not going to get something you really want. That can have a lot of value if it's channeled in the proper direction and it doesn't turn into, well, you know, let me call this coach and see why, or let me go try to play at a different team, or let's move across the country, or, you know, let me get on the computer on a chat room and bash everybody who did make the team because it's just going to make me feel better.
You know, there's a learning curve for everyone. And I know you've been through it. I've been through it. Everyone's going to go through it. So I'm with you. It's how you channel it and having those conversations with players to figure out how can we make this constructive? Because things are going to happen. You know, I like to say that fairness is another planet and we're not on it. So we get a bad call. You know, we're not on that planet of fair. We just play the hand that we're dealt. So couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I think, you know, and it's 2 years ago, I was fortunate, not, this isn't a me moment, but, you know, I was fortunate that I said I played for Steve Sterling and we won a game and I passed him on the all-time wins list. And he wrote me a nice note. I said, yeah, coach, I appreciate it, but I passed you on the all-time loss list a long time ago. You know, I passed you on that 16 months ago. You didn't reach out to me then, you know? So you used to have the most losses. Now I have the most losses. So, you know, I'm amazed. I tell this to people all the time. So Jerry York has the most wins in the history of college hockey. And I think his winning percentage is just a little bit over 60%. So basically he goes 3-2 every five games. Now, when you have 1200 wins and you think about Jerry York, you don't think about 3-2 record, you know, and that, now there's a few coaches, you know, Mike Hastings is an incredible coach, and guys, you know, Adam Krug up at Adrian, there's a lot of great coaches, Scott Sam, just cross country, but you know, the best of the best of the best are between 60 and 70. And when you boil down 6-4 to 3-2, I think it really starts to put some things in perspective about how much you're going to fail. You know, you look at the best coach in the NHL. I mean, their career winning percentage is like high fives. Like, oh, this guy's on the Mount Rushmore of coaches. Yeah, that's great. He won 54% of his games. Like, what? Holy cow. That's unbelievable. So everybody's failing at some level. You know, I saw something today. I'm a huge Crosby fan. I think I look at him like, people ask me why I like him. Like, he's the perfect body for a hockey player. If I was 6 foot, 200 pounds, wide hips. Like, that's Sidney Crosby. That's what I want. He only scores on 14% of his shots in his career. You know, 14%. You got some coaches out there sometimes when kids miss the net in practice doing push-ups. And Sidney Crosby's missing it. You know, he's not scoring 86 out of 100 shots he takes. And yet here we are sometimes and probably hit the net, or how'd he save that? Well, I don't know. Sid only scores on 14%. So I think Piccolo Pete here, who's 8 years old, might be a little less.
And 14 is ridiculously high, might we add.
Crazy, crazy. He's one of the best players in the history of the game, and it's 14%.
Yeah, the thing that I love about Crosby is just the leadership that he shows by example. Like, I think he's probably the hardest working player on the Penguins year in and year out. I mean, Andy's your best player. How can you not follow a guy like that?
John Hines is a friend of mine. We coached together in the Mass Satellite program, actually, and Kenny Roush, the three of us. And he told me when he got to Wilkes, and he was a part of Pittsburgh camp, and John had come from the national program with some really, really, you know, Patrick Kane, some high-end guys that were there when he was there. And he said, Sidney Crosby was by far the hardest working player he'd ever seen. And John had been international hockey, you know, coached at Wisconsin, coached at Lowell, played at BU with guys who are, you know, he may still have teammates who are playing for all, you know, I can't keep track of them, but like Mike Greer's the world, like incredibly hardworking, driven players. He played with Chris Drury. And he said, yeah, Sidney Crosby, the hardest working guy I've ever seen. And it's like, okay, makes sense.
Yeah, and then that's probably just – from seeing him 1 or 2 days in training camp and not even get to see the full season. And just, it's just unbelievable what he's been able to accomplish year in, year out. I think he's got, for 17 years, he's already gone over a point per game, which in today's day and age is just absolutely insane. And I think that the last 4 years have probably been the best hockey he's ever played. I think he just somehow guys like that just add an extra element each off season. So
yeah.
Going down that line, I'm curious, again, going more off the leadership component here, you know, how do you like to teach leadership or get leaders involved or grow that base? Because you already said earlier, you're trying to put the players in a position where it's their team. It's all about them on game day. You know, you did your work on practice, creating the games, the environment, and guiding.
Yeah, I think the first thing is you just mentioned a little bit, like, we don't live on planet Fair. You know, from the time the kids first come to Babson as a recruit to when they're through at Babson, when they graduate, I think they understand, and we tell them, you know, it's not going to be, there's not going to be any equality in that someone's going to be on the power play, someone isn't. Someone's going to play every game. You know, when you come in as freshmen, someone's going to play every game and be on the power play and maybe be all league. And someone's just going to be a bit player and they're going to have a small role, but we're going to treat you all equally, with pride and with dignity and with respect. So, you know, understanding the equality of their experience versus the equality of how you treat them. And I think that's the first piece for us, is that we're really honest with them. But we're honest with them from a place of, you know, I have three kids, you know, I want my son to be treated with dignity and respect. Yeah, there's times that you have hard conversations, but, you know, I don't think anybody who's ever been a part of our program could say anyone on our staff, from our trainer to the strength coach, to the coaches, to the people in the rink, would say, you know, hey, they're treated really well. It just doesn't mean that everyone's going to get the same fair and Planet Fair opportunities. Everyone's going to have the equal playing time, but they're going to be treated really well. And I think when you start from that point, you have a chance to grow really significant and meaningful relationships. And when you have those meaningful relationships, I think everyone has some leadership in them. And then they start to make better decisions, just like they do on the ice in a game. I mean, I think it's no different how we approach things off the ice, you know, shake people's hand firmly, look them in the eye, you know, be respectful, pick up, don't be the guy looking for someone else to pick something up. And I think the other thing that we try to do as a coaching staff, as far as leadership, and it really isn't leadership, I think it's just common decency, is don't expect anybody to do anything you can't do yourself. So if there's a towel on the ground, you pick it up. You know, I'm the last guy off the bus and I pick up all the pizza boxes, and it's not for anything other than it needs to be done. And so we've just had some, as every program feels they do and does, we've had some incredible kids who are really, really selfless. And I think they understand that we are literally all in it together. Everyone has the same share in our program or our success, whether you be a freshman, a senior, a captain, superstar, or just a role player. And I think one of the most exciting things for me happened this year, where it was a hard year for everybody in the world. Certainly in hockey, it was a challenge. In college hockey, it was challenging. We played our last home game and we put all of our seniors out on the ice. We had five senior skaters. We put them all out at the same time for the last 38 seconds. And we were winning a game. I think it was 6-7. And the kids on the bench were standing and banging the boards like squirts and hooting and hollering. Now, we had no spectators. So I wanted to call the other coach, be like, hey, we're not trying to be Bush League. They literally loved these kids so much. And they loved them because they were great leaders and great people and great friends and great teammates and great roommates. And that to me is how you build leadership, is you just keep entrusting them with more and more things and remove yourself a little bit. And certainly, as I said, the sheep herder, you point them in the right direction. We have things and ways we want to do things and a certain status we want to uphold or a certain, you know, regimen, but let them have the ownership of it. And when they have ownership of it, that passion for one another grows. They take more ownership of it. Ultimately, they become better leaders because then they start to want to continue the tradition. And so whether it be a game on Saturday after our week or Friday night after our week of practices, or just how we do things, you know, my job in a lot of ways has become easier the longer I've been at Babson, because the guys keep kind of, you know, telling, it's like how they talk about the Bible spreading. It was stories told generation after generation after generation, and someone finally wrote it down. And that's a little bit of us. You know, it's the stories of the roommate raffle. It's stories of how we practice. I went to a wedding of one of our players 5 years ago now, and there were 11 years worth of players at the wedding. And to me, that's our secret sauce. They really love one another. And when you graduate in 2018, you're going to know a guy who graduates in 2024 really well, even though you never cross paths. Because someone that was a freshman when you were a senior is going to be a senior when they're a freshman, and we're going to be connected that way, and we're going to get to know one another.
That's really special, and I'm going to bet, and I'm almost going to guarantee, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb, I'm going to guarantee it, that you're probably more proud of the, and you probably know how many weddings you've been invited to and attended of your players rather than the actual wins and losses you have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I love Babson. I love hockey. So I get to do what I love at a place I love. And I've said this often. I'm not sure, and this probably is not good for a job interview or for any self-promotion, I'm not sure I could do what I do, how I do it, any place else. because it might not be as sincere. That doesn't mean I don't think my coaching ability is lacking, but I am all in on Babson hockey. Like it is everything to me. It is my best friends. It is the reason I went to Babson. I joke often with my wife about two things. I said, one, I was the kid at Babson about the third weekends, like, geez, there's a lot of business classes here. You know, I should have probably known that going in. And two, I also have to hide the alumni magazine every month when it comes, because all my roommates and friends and teammates are retiring now at 51, 52, 53. And I'm certainly not. And, you know, I just keep telling her, oh, I don't think they're happy. And she says, I'm pretty sure they're happy. And I said, no, they're not happy like we are. But it really is. I'm just really blessed. I'm blessed that Babson gave me the opportunity. I am incredibly fortunate that we've been attractive to really some outstanding young men, great families who produce great young men. Athletics is important at Babson. It's not the Ohio State. It's not, Texas. It's not a lot of places, but within our own little world, it's really important. So I think we're attractive to kids who want a great education, who want to play sports at a high level, who want to have the opportunity to win. And then for us in hockey, we've added on this layer of just some incredible kids who keep attracting other great, incredible kids and going to the weddings. Actually, there's a couple this summer, and one I had to call the young man and say, I just, you know, got a kid going to college. I got two kids in prep school. I just can't swing it this year, and wrote him a long note. And the note I got back from him, you know, I'll cherish as much as being there. And it just, I feel badly. I told him I can't make it, but just the connection and the communication we have, and it's an honor to be invited. I mean, you don't need to invite a 53-year-old bald guy to come to your wedding to have fun. You know, there's probably a few more guys in your age range of 23 to 27 that would make it a lot more fun. But no, it's.
I've seen Mr. Clean on those commercials. He can dance. I'm assuming the same is true for you.
No, I got no game. I probably didn't have a lot of game as an athlete either, because it's translated to the dance floor. But it's an honor. It's a real treat. I think one of the great things, Greg, about coaching, that I think of all the time, is that all these kids I've coached, and sometimes now I stop and think, because there are kids who I coached when I started coaching at Colby or at Dartmouth or Brown, you know, they're now, you know, they've got kids going to college. I'm recruiting them, you know, and that's a little bit of a time warp. But regardless of what their status is, every player I've ever coached, particularly at Babson, is frozen at their time that they were at Babson. So I see Michael Phillips, not as now probably close to 30 Michael Phillips. I see him as 21-year-old Michael Phillips. Like, that's it forever for me. I see Michael at 21. And so all these kids that I've coached, my mind's eye is immediately when I talk to them, when I email them, when they text me, when you see them at a game, like, they're back in the locker room. They're that age, you know, they're that moment in time. I don't see them aging. I don't see them getting older. I'm always going to think of them as, you know, Mikey Phillips. I mean, heck, he's Michael. He's an unbelievable kid. He's played pro hockey. He's successful. He's in the business world. You know, he's not Mikey anymore, but to me, he's Mikey Phillips, you know, and I'll always see him that way. And it's just really, it's a great joy. And the connectivity that I have to the players in the program is probably, I like to win. But those are the things that when you're down and out, or when you're having some struggles, or when you're curious why something happened, inevitably it's one of those guys who shoots me a text and, hey coach, just wanted you to know, we're proud of you. Or, hey coach, today I did, you know, one of the guys texted me last night, and there were seven guys playing men's league together last night. And he texted me a picture of the locker room, and I started laughing. Like, it was like, and these kids are now out. One of them's out almost 9 years. And, you know, again, it was a group of kids from 2014, 2015, 2018, 2019, 2014, 2019, never played together. And they've all got their Babson gear on. It just brings a big smile and made me laugh, you know. And another guy will text me, hey coach, I thought of you today. You know, we did this at work. Those are the things I think that are really rewarding. That's why I say, you know, I think I'm a decent coach. There's a lot of great coaches, a lot better than me. I think I could coach someplace else, but could I replicate what we have at Babson someplace else? I'm not sure.
And I think the most important thing that you have going, and I'll toot your horn for you, is just that holistic picture of the person. It's not just about them as a hockey player. It's about them as the person. You know, at the end of the day, you can really tell that for you, you know, coaching is a little bit more like parenting. You know, sometimes they need a hug and sometimes they need a kick in the butt, but either way you can deliver that. And I agree. It's the stuff that you see them doing after you, or just the life lessons that they've taken from you and end up applying and having success with it. It's just the most fulfilling thing you can really have out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we tell each other, we love each other, and it's not, you know, falsely, oh, I love you. I mean, it's, you know, when the seniors graduate, it is tears and it is hugs and it's, I love you and I'll miss you. And the great news is they come back. I'm still there. I don't know which of that part is great. But you know, it really is. It is like parenting, and it doesn't mean more to me. You know, every successful coach across the country is doing these things. The great thing about Division III is, and we've had a number of kids play pro hockey at some level. We have a young man, Michael Vollman, who's in the Swiss Elite League. I mean, really accomplished player. But this is kind of the beginning of the end of hockey for them. Like, this is, you know, kind of the last stop. And I talked about my son going off to college earlier, and that's, you know, I think probably what I'm most proud of for our program and for all the coaches who I've worked with and all our players is, you know, we're kind of that last walk out the house. You know, they put on the tux and they walk out to get married, you know, and that's kind of their last night in your house when you're a parent, is they come home and put on their tux and they go get married. Or if it's your daughter, she puts on her wedding dress and you walk her down the aisle. And, you know, that's kind of, I think, the experience we have at Babson as the coaches, is that we're that father walking his daughter down the aisle, or we're that father giving his son a handshake, telling him we're proud of him as he walks out the door to get married. Because, you know, most of them are going to be in men's league, and most of them are going to do something, just like the NCAA commercial says ad nauseum, outside of athletics.
Chelios is playing men's league these days, yeah. I hear too, and he kept trying as long as he could to play. So yeah, all roads lead to men's league, whether you like it or not. Doesn't matter if you're Crosby or you're Greg Rivak or Jamie Rice.
Yeah, it's just it's great to be a part of that journey, and great to be kind of that. You know, I hope, again, for probably 90% of the kids who played at Babson, and even a couple of kids who have played professionally and loved it, said it wasn't the same. You know, I try to think that will be their last truly meaningful team experience. Because when you get to pro hockey, in some respects, everybody's a little bit, you know, out for themselves, because that's how you get paid more, you climb the ladder more, whatever. And that's no knock on pro hockey at all. I mean, obviously, it's what they should all aspire to. But as far as a meaningful, really, you know, we bigger than me type of experience, we're the last one they're going to have like that in athletics. And it's important, I think, to have it be a meaningful one.
Yep. You are the opposite of what USA Hockey wants. You are often the player's last coach. So definitely. But
I think there's a lot of people, if they're listening tonight, agree with that statement. I am the last thing USA Hockey wants.
Doubtful on that. I mean, you've been a pioneer for many years, and really appreciate you coming on to the podcast. It's a whole bunch of fun. You've talked about Babson, but if there's any other words of wisdom you want to throw out to anyone who might be listening, we're all ears. Otherwise, thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate you taking the time.
No, I appreciate you having me very much. It's been an honor, and I don't have any, you know, any pearls. I'm blessed. I've got a great family. I've got 3 kids who are all healthy, knock on wood, a supporting, loving wife. And, you know, I think anybody that gives their time to this game, who helps kids, without the kids, I don't have a job. You know, if there's no Mite hockey, there's no college hockey. So I appreciate all the coaches who do whatever they do, wherever they do it, because ultimately, we're all part of, you know, shepherding these kids to the next level. And enjoy the ride. I start to think this is my 32nd year coaching, and it's hard to believe sometimes. I joked with a good friend of mine yesterday, you know, we've become the old guys at the back of the room, and we're going to have to pass this off sooner rather than later. Maybe not. I tell my wife 10 years, she tells me she doesn't think we're going to be ready to retire then. So I have to check my TI cref when I get off this, but you know, I'm closer to the end of coaching than I am the starting, and it's been a heck of a ride. And I'm most thankful for all the people who've helped me, who, you know, you said I've got a minute, I'm down to 10 seconds, and there's too many people to thank. But for everybody who has helped me or coached with me or offered me advice, I've been all ears, and I appreciate it, and hopefully I can continue to do the same and pay that forward, because I wouldn't be here without an awful lot of people who've made me what I am today.
Awesome. Thanks, Jamie, for coming on. We'll catch you next time.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you for tuning into the Hockey IQ podcast. We are Hockey's Arsenal, Greg Rivak and Dan Dukart. Together, we've come together to create a platform and a community to expand on hockey intelligence, hockey IQ, whatever you want to call it. We're very passionate about seeing this game played smarter and better, and continue to develop itself to the next level and staying on the cutting edge of things. So you can find us at Hockey's Arsenal on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. We're also at hockeysarsenal.com. From there, you can find some resources and some options to work with us. We're excited to continue this. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, follow, and share. You can also join up for our newsletter as well, where we're going to tackle anything Hockey IQ related. So we're excited to have everyone here and continue to build.
That concludes this week's episode. Thanks for joining us here at Hockey IQ. If you haven't already, take a quick moment to hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and drop a review. If you want to be a great teammate, even recommend us to a friend. You can follow us at Hockey's Arsenal on Twitter and Instagram. Check out the website, hockeysarsenal.com, where you can subscribe to the weekly newsletter. You won't regret it. Catch you beauts here next week for a brand new episode.